From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today I announce my decision to stand down from the leadership of the Labour Party. The party will now select a new leader. On the 27th of June, I will tender my resignation from the office of Prime Minister to the Queen.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair announces his plans to resign. After more than a decade in power, he defends his decision to send troops to Iraq in a staunch support of President Bush. We'll go to London to speak with author Tariq Ali. And two men in Britain have been convicted of leaking a classified memo that allegedly revealed Bush told Blair in 2004 he wanted to bomb the headquarters of the TV network Al Jazeera in Doha. Then to Capitol Hill, where journalist Jeremy Scahill testifies before a House panel on private military contractors.
As the country debates current and future Iraq policy, Congress owes it to the American people to take down the curtain of secrecy surrounding these shadow forces that often act in the name and on the payroll of the people of this country.
And we'll speak with two Harvard students who've entered the ninth day of their hunger strike. Two other students have been hospitalized. They're demanding a pay raise and improve working conditions for campus security guards. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The civilian death toll from the U.S. bombing of a village in Afghanistan this week could be nearly four times the official figure of 21. The New York Times reports residents of the Sarwan Kalak village are claiming as many as 80 civilians were killed. At least three houses were destroyed. Most victims identified so far are women and children. A majority of Iraqi lawmakers have approved a draft bill calling for a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops and a freeze on current troop levels. The measure would require Iraqi leaders to seek parliamentary approval for any extension of foreign troops when the U.N. mandate expires this year. At least 138 of Iraq's 275-member parliament have signed on. The Iraqi draft bill comes as the House has approved a measure that would fund the Iraq war in two stages. Money would be provided until July, but then held up until President Bush reports progress on reaching several benchmarks. President Bush has vowed to veto the measure, as he did the Democrats' war funding bill last week. This is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
Legislation that we are putting forth on the floor today gives the president the money that he needs for the next few months to engage in the war in Iraq. But it has accountability. And that is something the president has always resisted. And Democrats are not going to give the president a blank check for a war without end. What we want to do is go to the conference and negotiate with the Senate and with the White House on legislation to bring this war to an end. We believe that the legislation that we will present on the floor today will be in furtherance of reaching that goal.
The resolution was approved after anti-war Democrats failed to pass a measure that would put an end to most U.S. military operations in Iraq within 9 months. The vote got more supporters than expected, with 171 in favor and 255 opposed. Bill author Congressmember Jim McGovern of Massachusetts said, quote, "This is proof the United States Congress is getting closer to where the American people already are." Vice President Dick Cheney is in Abu Dhabi today following a two-day visit to Iraq. On Thursday, Cheney addressed a gathering of U.S. troops in Tikrit.
Many of you have had your deployments extended, and that puts an unexpected hardship on you and your families. I want you to know the extension is vital to the mission. The Army and the country appreciate the extra burden that you carry.
Cheney's Middle East tour will also take him to Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan. In other Iraq news, four Iraqi journalists have been killed in a shooting in the northern city of Kirkuk. It was the second attack against Iraqi media workers in less than a week. British Prime Minister Tony Blair has announced he'll step down next month after more than a decade in office.
So, I've come back here to Sedgefield, to my constituency, where my political journey began and where it's fitting that it should end. Today I announce my decision to stand down from the leadership of the Labour Party. The party will now select a new leader. On the 27th of June, I will tender my resignation from the office of Prime Minister to the Queen.
Blair will stay on until the Labor Party elects a new leader, widely expected to be Finance Minister Gordon Brown. While Blair's announcement drew praise from leaders around the world, critics say he'll be remembered for following President Bush into an unnecessary war. This is Brian Haugh, an anti-war protester who's camped outside the British Parliament for nearly 6 years.
I voted for Mr. Tony Blair the first time, along with many people in my country. It was the big white hope, wasn't he? After Thatcher, the warmonger. And we hoped for something better, didn't we? I'm Christian Tony. I'm going to do right by everyone. Have you seen what he's done?
Meanwhile, in Iraq, a Basra resident identified by his first name, Mahmoud, said Blair's departure was of little consequence.
British military bases will remain. I do not think they will leave the Basra province. They've built bases in Shuaiba and in many other areas.
Russia is accusing the U.S. of trying to build a new Berlin Wall with its plan for a new missile shield in Europe. This is Russian Chief of Staff General Yuri Balyavsky.
Today it is suggested to us, without any assessment of the threat, but simply accepting a hypothetical threat of the sort I mentioned, notably from Iran, that we should build new Berlin walls in Europe. We are against this. We do not consider that today there is any threat of the sort that would allow us to go back to what we have left behind.
The comments come one day after Russian President Vladimir Putin compared U.S. foreign policy with Nazi Germany. Survivors of a boat capsizing that killed at least 61 people fleeing Haiti last week say they were deliberately overturned. The survivors say they were just minutes from the British territory of the Turks and Caicos Islands when a patrol boat rammed them and left them to drown in shark-infested waters. More than 160 people were on board. Both the Turks and Caicos and British governments have declined comment. In East Timor, the Nobel laureate, José Ramos Horta, has won the presidential race with nearly 70% of the vote. It's East Timor's first presidential election since becoming an independent nation in 2002. In Los Angeles, attorneys with the National Lawyers Guild have filed suit against city and police officials on behalf of immigrant groups and protesters injured during the LAPD's crackdown on the May Day rally in MacArthur Park. Police with riot guns fired hundreds of rubber bullets, shot tear gas and clubbed protesters and journalists. At least 10 people were injured. More developments in the U.S. attorney scandal. Investigative journalist Murray Wass is reporting the Bush administration has withheld emails showing senior White House and Justice Department officials collaborated to conceal the role of White House strategist Karl Rove in installing his former deputy Timothy Griffin as U.S. attorney in Arkansas. The emails show Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's former chief of staff, D. Kyle Sampson, worked with White House officials on two letters that misled Congress on the appointment and Rove's role. In media news, CBS has dismissed an Iraq War veteran over his involvement in an ad campaign criticizing the war. General John Batiste appears in an ad from the group VoteVets.org. Batiste has been working as a CBS News consultant. The right-wing talk show host Rush Limbaugh is coming under criticism for airing a song about Democratic presidential hopeful Barack Obama called Barack the Magic Negro. The song is played on Limbaugh's program in recent weeks.
Here we go. This is Paul Shanklin as Al Sharpton about Barack Obama.
Barack the Magic Negro lives in D.C. The L.A. Times, they call him. Cause he's not authentic like me. Yeah, the guy from the L.A. paper said he made guilty whites feel good. They'll vote for him and not for me, cause he's not from the hood.
Senator Obama was given Secret Service protection last week in part due to threatening messages posted on white supremacist websites. And finally, a coalition of Latino organizations has reached an agreement with the filmmaker Ken Burns on a forthcoming World War II documentary that's been criticized for ignoring the role of Latino soldiers. The 14-hour film, The War, initially included no interviews with Latino veterans, even though over 500,000 Latinos served in the war. The documentary also included no interviews with any Native American veterans. After an initial refusal, Burns has now agreed to incorporate Latino voices into a new cut of the film. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
Juan, you just did your New York Daily News piece today on the whole controversy around the Ken Burns documentary, which is scheduled to air on PBS in September.
Yes, and I mentioned this agreement that was reached yesterday was announced. It was reached the day before. But it's not clear, first of all, that all of the Latino organizations that have been concerned about this issue have signed on to this. It was basically the American GI Forum and a coalition of Washington groups of Latinos. There's still quite a few questions because the Burns' people are saying or told me yesterday that they are going to add some Latino interviews, but they're not changing the basic film. And I asked them, well, how are you going to do that? And they weren't quite clear yet. I'm not sure that they have decided. But interestingly, Burns left this week for the Cannes Film Festival, which begins next week, where he's going to show the film, the current film that he has. So clearly, I think that was part of the pressure that they want to maintain what they consider the artistic integrity of the film that they already have, but somehow deal with what they acknowledge is a huge and growing criticism of their total elimination of the Latino experience or all the many hundreds of thousands of Latinos who participated in the war. But, I mean, my column dealt with the historic track record of Burns on similar issues with other films that he's had in the past. He clearly has a problem in not recognizing the important contributions Latinos have made throughout American history.
His special documentaries on jazz and on baseball.
Yes, on jazz and on baseball especially. The baseball is most glaring because there are a lot more baseball fans than there are jazz followers in the United States. But I think that the jazz, his failure to recognize the enormous contributions that Latinos have made to jazz from the very beginning in the New Orleans in the 19th century is just glaring and has all musical experts have had them in an uproar for many years now. And you know, I think the important thing about Burns is to understand is he is perhaps the person who has most presented history to more people in the United States than any actual historian. More people, and his films are used in public schools. And that's the other thing. He has a huge marketing campaign for the public schools to take this as a teaching instrument. So that's why it's so especially important that if he's marketing that way, expecting to make a lot of money off the sales to public schools, then I think he has a special responsibility to make sure his history is accurate.
Well, we'll certainly continue to follow this controversy around his World War II documentary, The War.
Right. Well, we're going to move now to England, where British Prime Minister Tony Blair has announced he plans to resign next month after more than a decade in power.
Today, I announce my decision to stand down from the leadership of the Labour Party. The party will now select a new leader. On the 27th of June, I will tender my resignation from the office of Prime Minister to the Queen.
Blair made the announcement on Thursday in a speech to Labour Party members in his Sedgefield constituency. He will stay on in Downing Street until the Labour Party elects a new leader, widely expected to be Finance Minister Gordon Brown. In his address, Blair defended his decision to send British troops to war in Iraq.
But I ask you to accept one thing. Hand on heart, I did what I thought was right.
Blair, President Bush's closest ally, invoked 9/11 to defend his staunch backing of U.S. foreign policy.
And then came the utterly unanticipated and dramatic September 11, 2001, and the death of 3,000 or more on the streets of New York. And I decided we should stand shoulder to shoulder with our oldest ally. And I did so out of belief. And so Afghanistan. And then Iraq, the latter bitterly controversial. And removing Saddam and his sons from power, as with removing the Taliban, was over with relative ease. But the blowback since from global terrorism and those elements that support it has been fierce and unrelenting and costly. And for many, it's simply isn't and can't be worth it. For me, I think we must see it through. They, the terrorists who threaten us here and around the world, will never give up if we give up. It is a test of will and of belief, and we can't fail it.
Back in Washington, President Bush paid tribute to Tony Blair at a Pentagon news conference.
First of all, I'll miss Tony Blair. He is a political figure who is capable of thinking over the horizon. He's a long-term thinker. I have found him to be a man who's kept his word, which sometimes is rare in the political circles I run in. When Tony Blair tells you something, as we say in Texas, you can take it to the bank. We've got a relationship such that we can have really good discussions, and so I'm gonna miss him. He's a remarkable person, and I consider him a good friend.
We return now to London to Tariq Ali, historian and one of the editors of the New Left Review, as well as author of many books, including Rough Music, Blair, Bombs, Baghdad, London Terror. He joins us from a London studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tariq.
Hi, Amy. Good to be with you again.
It's good to have you with us. Talk about Blair resigning.
Well, it was classic New Labour spin. Well orchestrated, designed for the global media networks, self-serving speech, a carefully hand-picked audience so that there would be no trouble at all, and actually for him a very bad speech. I mean, I've always regarded Blair as a second-rate politician with a third-rate mind, but he's had better speech writers than this, and I wondered whether he'd written it himself. I mean, it's sort of full of contradictions and half-truths. I mean, if he was going to see this so-called war against terror through, why quit? We had no real accounting of why he's leaving as prime minister. And the fact is, he's leaving is because he's hated. And the reason he's hated is because he joined the neocons in Washington and went to war against Iraq, which now 78% of the population in this country oppose. And when people are being asked, what will Blair's legacy be? A large majority is saying Iraq. And I think that's what he will be remembered for, as a prime minister who took a reluctant and skeptical country into a war designed by Washington and its neoconservative strategists, all of whom are in crisis. And you listen to Blair now and his successor Brown, and they sound much worse than any Democrat in the Senate or the House, because they realize the war's unpopular. These guys carry on living in a tiny bubble, media bubble, which they construct. And I think the BBC's sycophancy, the way in which they portrayed him yesterday as if he was a sort of dead Princess Diana, doesn't do them proud. It was a low point in BBC journalism, with one of their political correspondents saying, gosh, look at him, isn't he a winner? Well, he isn't a winner, which is why he's leaving. And a reluctant party has said farewell to him because they think they'll lose the next election if he's in charge. That's what's going on.
And Tariq, he did try in his speech to point to the continued prosperity, economic prosperity of the British under his tenure. Your response to that?
Well, I mean, you know, it is prosperous for some people and some regions of the country. But if you look, for instance, at various regions in the north and northeast, you have a tiny proportion of the population which is relatively well off, and you have people who are not so well off, people who are dependent on social welfare, which is constantly under attack. You have a two-tier health system now, which you never used to, where if you have money, you can go in a hospital and get treatment any minute. But if you don't, you have to stand in queues. You have lots of hospitals who he sold to private finance initiatives, which are now saying they can't fund their hospitals anymore. The failures, the domestic failures, are not being talked about. And you have large-scale corruption. I mean, recently, a mega scandal with a British arms company, which had paid massive bribes to leading Saudis, including probably members of the royal family. This came up. Blair put a stop to it. His attorney general, not unlike Gonzalez, said we can't sue because the country's future interests are at stake, so corruption's fine. It's a total mess. It's something is rotten in this kingdom. And a very sycophantic media rarely talks about it. It's left to small indie media outlets or satirical magazines like Private Eye, basically to carry on regular reporting of what is going on. I don't think his legacy is anything new. He tried to carry on what Margaret Thatcher did, and the results have not been too dissimilar. He's had a bloodier reign than Thatcher. He has taken Britain into more wars and actually antagonized, as I point out in a number of recent articles, large swathes of the British establishment who feel very ashamed that they're being led by a leader who is so totally and completely and a sort of favored attack dog in the imperial kennel.
Tariq Ali, President Bush in Washington, D.C., said he'll miss Tony Blair and that he's ready to work with his presumed successor, Gordon Brown, confident that he, quote, understands the consequences of failure in Iraq. Talk about that statement and also who Gordon Brown is.
Well, I think Bush is right. He will miss Blair. I mean, you can't have a more loyal politician in Europe than Blair. I mean, he's done virtually everything the United States has asked for, and not just after 9/11. Even prior to that, he was extremely pro-Washington in everything. He never raised any questions. So I think Washington will miss him. Mercifully, very few people in this country will. Now, as to his successor, Gordon Brown, he backed the war on Iraq, as he himself said yesterday, and it was felt it was necessary. He backed the war on Afghanistan, felt that that was completely necessary, and think that they wiped out all the problems with this. But they're completely wrong. On all the central issues of the day, there is no difference between Blair and Brown. The tone Brown adopts will probably be marginally less aggressive, but in terms of substance, there's nothing to choose between them. And this is essentially yet another New Labour trick. Okay, we've got rid of the big bad warmonger, and we've got a decent prime minister again, but this guy is also a warmonger. The difference is he is more intelligent than Blair. If I were to say that Blair is a second-rate politician with a third-rate mind, I'd say Brown is a second-rate politician with a second-rate mind, which makes him a bit better than Blair. But he's no different, and he's going to carry on in Britain in exactly the same old way. They've already lost Scotland, which is a Labour stronghold. They're declining in Wales, and they will lose England at the next election. So essentially, they will hand the countries back to the Tories, and that, too, will be no different. So it's a grim prospect which faces us here.
Well, I wanted to ask you that in terms of the political prospects for progressive thinking people within Britain, for the labor movement, for the racial minorities that are increasingly under attack in your country. What are the alternatives that those folks have?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, the nationalist parties in Scotland and Wales are the only alternatives in those countries which are more progressive than Labour, Conservative or Liberal. I mean, they're against nuclear weapons in Scotland, against Trident missiles, against the war in Iraq, want more money spent on public services, health, education, etc. So the progressive voices at the moment exist only in Scotland and Wales. In England, which has the bulk of the money and is the largest chunk of the country, there is no real alternative, and that is a big tragedy. Of course, there is Ken Livingstone, the mayor of London, who is probably the only Labour politician respected by sections of the population. He has been very, very strong in defending racial minorities, in attacking Islamophobic trends in British culture and in staunchly attacking the war in Iraq. He came out very hard against that war when it first started and warned prophetically that it would put the citizens of London at risk. But he, after all, is a mayor of a large city, that's all. On a national level, the alternatives at the moment are very limited. And I think we will likely carry on in this way till New Labour is defeated, as it probably will be in the next elections, which might then open up some possibilities of new forces emerging. But at the moment, it's grim.
Finally, on a different issue, Tariq Ali, as we wrap up, Alan Johnston, who has not been heard from since he was kidnapped in Gaza, was just named Broadcasting Journalist of the Year at the annual London Press Awards. The award was accepted by his father, Graham Johnston, and the BBC Director General, Mark Thompson. Your comment?
Well, you know, I feel for him, you know, and I feel for all journalists in war zones who try and do their reporting and are kidnapped. But, you know, that happens on the one hand. And at the other hand, what we have is, I mean, you know, one can sympathize with Johnston and his family in hope that he is released. But on the other hand, Amy, what is going on in this country is that whistleblowers are being punished. Yesterday, a British civil servant who leaked information regarding a secret memo was sentenced to 6 months in prison by an incredibly unpleasant judge who said, "You put our country at risk." Put our country at risk?
Tariq
by
Ali,
coming out with the truth is just astonishing.
We're going to go to break, and we come back. We'll be joined by another guest in that London studio that you are sitting in to talk about that very issue. About a memo that reportedly says that President Bush asked Prime Minister Tony Blair to bomb the Doha headquarters of Al Jazeera. I want to thank you for being with us, and we'll be back in the London studio in a minute. The Sex Pistols here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
A pair of British men were sentenced to jail on Thursday for leaking a classified memo that revealed President Bush told British Prime Minister Tony Blair in April 2004 that he wanted to bomb the Doha headquarters of the Arabic television network Al Jazeera. On Thursday, a former civil servant named David Keogh was sentenced to 6 months in jail for violating Britain's Official Secrets Act. A former parliamentary researcher named Leo O'Connor was given a three-month sentence. They were convicted after a highly secretive trial. The British government maintained that the memo was so sensitive that most of the trial could not take place in public in the interests of national security.
The Daily Mirror newspaper first reported on the existence of the memo, but the British government has placed a gag order on other news organizations. To talk more about the memo, Davide Simonetti of the website Blair Watch joins us in London. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Explain exactly what you understand this memo to say.
Well, we've not seen the memo, so we can't know exactly what's on it at all. But what we understand from what we've read is an alleged plan by the President George Bush to bomb the Al Jazeera offices in Doha after not being very pleased with some unflattering coverage. This is round about the time of the attack on Fallujah, of course. There's also allegedly other stuff in the memo about the attack on Fallujah. And that also might have been deemed as sensitive in the court case.
And was this a proposal by President Bush to have the British bomb the headquarters, or that the United States was going to do it and they wanted to get the viewpoint and perspective of Prime Minister Blair?
I think, and of course I can't be sure because none of us have seen this memo, that it would have been an American action, and it would have been just a request of to see what Tony Blair would have thought of the idea. That's my take on it from the little I've seen. But of course we don't know, because nothing's been disclosed.
In February of 2006, Democracy Now! Traveled to Doha to attend the second Al Jazeera forum. During our Democracy Now! Broadcast from Qatar, we spoke with Al Jazeera's managing director, Wata Khanfar. I asked him for his response to the 2004 memo.
You know, I would say that I was, at the moment of time, the bureau chief of Baghdad, so I was aware of the daily problems that we faced in our work in Iraq. More than 20 of our colleagues were detained at certain checkpoints. Some of them were spent, you know, days in jail, actually, in very severe circumstances. Some of them were tortured in Baghdad. The situation in Fallujah, it happened that we were the only team, the only crew that we had. Al Jazeera had the only crew inside Al Fallujah, reporting live, actually. I remember when Kimmett made this kind of a statement, he was in the box, in our screen, the other half of the screen, the other box, was showing live images from the hospital of Fallujah about civilians who have been killed. He was telling us that you are fabricating the story, you are lying, you are not telling the truth, you know. And the Arab world was watching what has been happening. Now, of course, recently, a lot of media started to apologize about the misinformation regarding Fallujah and the fact that they were reporting incidents or the attack on Fallujah from the embedded with the American side. So the situation in Fallujah, that was the issue.
That's a good question. That is Wata Khanfar. He's the managing director of Al Jazeera, when we spoke to him in Doha in Al Jazeera's headquarters. Juan?
Davide Simonetti, I'd like to ask you about the difficulties that journalists have in Britain reporting on stories like this when there is so much that the government does not permit you to discuss or write about in public.
Well, of course, it's almost impossible. The Official Secrets Act, which our Attorney General, Lord Goldsmith, invoked to stop the disclosure of the memo, that was just the beginning. I mean, in the papers today, we're hearing that the judge is now in the case of David Keogh and Leo Kanner, is now imposing further gagging orders that even stuff that was disclosed in open court can't be discussed. There's a real effort to stop anything of this story getting out, even though much of it is in the public domain.
As a blogger with the website Blair Watch, have said if you can get a hold of this memo, you are going to print it in spite of the Official Secrets Act?
Yes, we will. We'll do it with not just on our own, but there are hundreds of bloggers that have agreed to do it with us, and also some mainstream publications have agreed to as well. And I think if it was released like that, there wouldn't be anything much they could do about it to prosecute, if it suddenly exploded into the public domain.
Davide Simonetti, Al Jazeera submitted a Freedom of Information application in early 2006 requesting the disclosure of the contents of the memo, but the request has been denied. Finally, we just have a few seconds, but these two men, the men who now have been jailed, David Keogh and the Member of Parliament researcher Leo Kanner, who are they? They are in jail now.
Well, one's a researcher, one was an assistant. They seem to be used as, I wouldn't say scapegoats, because David O'Connor did actually try to release this. But there's other problems as well. The MP Peter Kilfoyle disclosed the contents of the Al Jazeera memo to John Latham in the States. The MP who is the boss of Leo O'Connor also did this. There's allegedly from what we're reading, it seems that the government has picked on these two because it would be embarrassing to start bringing charges against British MPs, members of Parliament.
Davide Simonetti, thank you for being with us. We'll continue to follow the story. Blogger with the website Blair Watch. As we turn now back to the United States, to Capitol Hill. Juan.
Yes, there are over 120,000 private contractors currently deployed in Iraq. And yesterday, a House panel put some of the harshest criticisms of this privatization of the war into the congressional record for the first time. The House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense held a hearing on Thursday about defense contracting. Testifying before the panel was journalist Jeremy Scahill and filmmaker Robert Greenwald. Jeremy is an investigative reporter for The Nation magazine, author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and a former producer here at Democracy Now! In his opening remarks, he spoke about the lack of oversight of the tens of thousands of contractors deployed in Iraq.
At a time when the administration seems unwilling to subject its war strategy to oversight by the Congress, we face the widespread use of private forces seemingly accountable to no effective system of oversight or law. While tens of thousands of these contractors provide logistical support services for the military, thousands are heavily armed private soldiers roaming Iraq. We do know that there are 48,000 employees of private military companies in Iraq alone. These forces work for U.S. companies like Blackwater, Triple Canopy, and DynCorp, as well as companies from across the globe. Some contractors make in a month what many active duty soldiers make in a year. Indeed, there are private contractors in Iraq who make more money than the Secretary of Defense or the commanding generals. The testimony about private contractors that I hear most often from active duty soldiers falls into two categories: resentment and envy. They ask what message their country is sending them. While many soldiers lack basic protective equipment, facts well known to this committee, they're in a war zone where they see the private soldiers. They whiz by in better vehicles, better armor, better weapons, wearing the corporate logo instead of the American flag, and pulling in much more money. They ask, are our lives worth less? Of course, there are many cases where contractors have hoarded the profits at the top, and money is not filtered down to the contractors on the ground or armor to protect them, and we can discuss that later. The second reaction I hear from active duty soldiers is that they see what they refer to as these rock star private contractors, and they want to be like them. So we have a phenomenon of soldiers leaving the active duty military to jump over to the private sector. There's now slang on the ground in Iraq for this jump. It's called going Blackwater. To put it bluntly, these private forces create a system where national duty is outbid by profits. And yet these forces are being used for mission critical activities. Indeed, in January, General David Petraeus admitted that on his last tour in Iraq, he himself was protected by private contract security. Just as there's a double standard in pay, there's a double standard in the application of the law. Soldiers who commit crimes or acts of misconduct are prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. There have been some 64 courts martial on murder-related charges alone in Iraq. Compare that to the lack of prosecution of contractors. Despite the fact that tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of contractors have gone in and out of Iraq since March of 2003, only two have faced any criminal prosecution, two. One was a KBR employee alleged to have stabbed a coworker in a kitchen. The other pled guilty to possession of child pornography images on his computer at Abu Ghraib prison. In 4 years, there have been no prosecutions for crimes against Iraqis committed by contractors, and not a single known prosecution of an armed contractor. That either means that we have tens of thousands of Boy Scouts working as armed contractors, or something is fundamentally wrong with the system. Brigadier General Carl Horst of the 1st Infantry Division became so outraged by contractor unaccountability that he began tracking contractor violence in Baghdad. In just 2 months, General Horst documented 12 cases of contractors shooting at civilians. That resulted in 6 deaths and 3 injuries, and that's just 2 months and one general. They have not been prosecuted under the UCMJ. They have not been prosecuted under U.S. civilian law. They have not been prosecuted under Iraqi law. U.S. contractors in Iraq reportedly have their own motto: what happens here today stays here today. That should be chilling to everyone who believes that warfare, above all government functions, must be subject to transparency, accountability, and the rule of law. These are forces operating in the name of the United States of America. Iraqis do not see contractors as separate from soldiers. Understandably, they see them all as the occupation. Contractor misconduct is viewed as American misconduct. While there's currently a debate in this Congress about how to hold these private forces accountable, the political will to act remains shockingly absent. Given the vast size of this private force spread across the most dangerous war zone in the world, it is not at all clear how effective oversight would work. We already know that auditors cannot visit many reconstruction sites because of security concerns. Journalists are locked in the green zone. The army is stretched to the max. So what entity then is supposed to have the capacity or the ability to oversee the men who've been brought to Iraq to go where no one else will? Members of Congress tell me they've been stonewalled in attempts to gain detailed information about the activities of these private contractors. I think it's a disturbing commentary that I've received phone calls from members of Congress asking me for documents on the contractors and not the other way around. In the current discussion in the Congress on this issue, what is seldom discussed is how this system, the privatization of war, has both encouraged and enabled the growth and creation of companies who've benefited and stand to gain even more from an escalation of the war. In closing, while I think this Congress needs to take urgent action on issues of oversight, accountability, and transparency of these private forces operating with our tax dollars and in the name of the United States, there's a deeper issue that often gets overlooked. This war contracting system has intimately linked corporate profits to an escalation of war and conflict. These companies have no incentive to decrease their footprint in the war zone and every incentive to increase it. As the country debates current and future Iraq policy, Congress owes it to the American people to take down the curtain of secrecy surrounding these shadow forces that often act in the name and on the payroll of the people of this country.
Journalist Jeremy Scahill, author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, testifying before Congress. We'll go back to that testimony after break.
Close your eyes, put down your gun, rest yourself, catch your breath. Beyond this wall, below that hill, behind that house, lies a dusty death. Yeah. You learn real fast if you're halfway smart. Keep your head down, bide your time. I've seen a 100 kids like you, they take a bullet, we send them down the line. That one there, he's just a kid, he's maybe 14, but don't you be fooled. His father's fathers for 200 years learned to fight in a harsher school. They whipped the British and the Russians too, from the Khyber Pass to the Khakin Hills. My guess is 100
Garnet years Rogers, now. Fight to live another day. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We return now to Jeremy Scahill, the journalist testifying before the House Appropriations Subcommittee on Defense on Thursday. Filmmaker Robert Greenwald also testified. After their opening remarks, lawmakers had a chance to question them. This is Republican Congressmember Jack Kingston of Georgia.
I want to ask Mr. Scahill something. You have described Eric Prince. I'm going to quote you directly. The man behind this empire is Eric Prince, a secretive conservative Christian, ex-Navy SEAL, multimillionaire, who bankrolls the president and his allies with major campaign contributions. Now, I guess, is it your premise that because Blackwater has contributed heavily to the president, that maybe, A, that's how they got the job, B, that's how they can charge what they're charging, C, that's why there's no oversight, or D, all of the above?
Well, no. I mean, I think, first of all, Blackwater is a company that has very deep connections in U.S. Intelligence, in the military. It does indeed have political connections to the White House. I do think it also has, it's viewed, I think, in some official circles as being a very forward-thinking company that provides very innovative services. I think it's a combination of the political connections of the company and the kinds of services that it provides. Mr. Prince likes to refer to Blackwater as the Federal Express of the national security apparatus. What I find concerning is the fact that not only is Mr. Prince a significant contributor to several of the campaign causes of Republicans who are in influential positions, particularly in the years of the Republican-controlled Congress, as well as to the White House, but he has deep connections to some of the religious right organizations that have come to a position of prominence in this country. I think this is a company that embodies a lot of what President Eisenhower warned against in his farewell address in 1961.
Okay. Let me ask you now, being a conservative Christian, is there's a problem with that?
No, there's no problem with being a conservative Christian. The problem
you said now, you said, I mean, you're saying he gives money to the Republican causes, and then you say to the religious right, and I'm having trouble connecting
that. Well, let's unpack that a little bit. I have an issue.
I want to give you an opportunity to, when you say a guy's secretive, which is, you know, derogatory, multimillionaire, bankrolled to the president, is derogatory, and then you put secret that he's a conservative Christian. I want to just, you know, give you an opportunity to explain yourself.
I have a concern when someone is being someone is running a company that's being tasked with mission critical activities in a Muslim country, who's a board member of an organization that believes that the Bible is the only infallible word of God. I have a problem with a company whose one of its senior executives is an open member of the Military Order of Malta, a Christian militia dating back to the First Crusades. Well, our president has used that term crusade. I think it's disturbing.
My time here now. So you wouldn't want a Christian running it. Would you want somebody who's Jewish? Because, you know, as you know, probably if Iraq.
It's not about the individual religion, Mr. Kingston. It's not about the religion. It's about the politics.
I didn't bring religion.
It's about the politics of his
reclaiming the town. I didn't bring religion up. You brought it up. You put here that he's a conservative Christian, and then you just stated the reason why you have concern about it. And I can understand what you're saying, but I would also say if Iraq falls, it's quite likely Israel would be next in line. And so, you know, there'd be concern from, you know, our Jewish neighbors over there that, so I just was a little perplexed here.
Republican Congressmember Jack Kingston of Georgia went on to ask Jeremy Scahill about the laws governing contractors in war when he was interrupted by Democratic Congressmember Norm Dix of Washington.
One of your statements, it said that Bremer gave a blanket waiver of immunity to these companies against being brought under Iraqi law.
It was an edict that was issued by Ambassador Bremer called Order 17. It was issued the day before he left Baghdad in June of 2004, and it granted sweeping immunity to all contractors under Iraqi law at a time when he was allegedly handing over sovereignty to an Iraqi government. I thought it was a strange definition of sovereignty to basically defang the judicial system in Iraq.
Perhaps that could be one of the things that we could look at. What would be, and I think that's that I didn't know about that. That's good. What else would you say?
I mean, I think that ultimately what we need to do is de-link corporate profits from an escalation of conflict. I think we need to pass effective anti-mercenary legislation. The nation of South Africa, for instance, last summer passed anti-mercenary legislation that I think could be studied by the U.S. Congress. Of course, the African continent has been rampaged by mercenaries for so many decades, and I think that we could learn a lot from our South African brothers and sisters and what they did in their parliament last summer. I also think, though, that we need to get at the heart of a system that encourages the linking of war and profits. Let me ask you, Mr. Kingston, do you believe that it's right to have some of these private contractors being paid more than the Secretary of Defense?
I actually, believe it or not, don't believe people in government should be in it for money, because, believe it or not, most of us here are here for ideological reasons.
Republican Congress member Kingston of Georgia questioning Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy's traveling around the country. You can see where he'll be at blackwaterbook.com. That was testimony before a House subcommittee yesterday in Washington, D.C. Juan?
Well, a group of students at Harvard University have entered their ninth day of a hunger strike as part of a campaign to demand a pay raise and improve working conditions for campus security guards. The students want the university to intervene in salary negotiations between the security guards and their employer, Allied Barton.
Two of the hunger-striking students join us now from Boston. Jamila Martin is a senior at Harvard and organizer with the Student Labor Action Movement. Benjamin Landau Bespiel is a first-year student at Harvard. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jamila, I understand, have two students gone into the hospital now who've been on hunger strike?
So one person was hospitalized for low serum sodium levels, and then probably four other people have been held at different times by health services because they've had low levels and have eventually been released as those have been raised.
Please explain the issue. Why are you fasting?
So we're fasting because Harvard refuses to take any responsibility for security officers because they're outsourced. And that's really the crux of the issue, that Harvard refuses to intervene in any way in the negotiations on behalf of security officers.
And Benjamin Landau, what's been the response of Harvard to your hunger strike?
They've refused to listen to us. We've been sending letters to the president every day. We've been asking to meet with him. We've been having demonstrations daily. And so far, the voice of the students hasn't been heard. They've been ignoring us, but this is a struggle that will continue until we get what we want.
We did ask Harvard University to join us for this discussion. They refused, though they did send a statement that was published in The Crimson. We also called Allied Barton. They also said they would not come on. Ben, can you explain the situation for the security guards and how they compare to security guards at other campuses?
Yeah, sure. So right now, the security guards at Harvard are making $12.60 an hour, which is not on par with what other workers at Harvard are making or what workers at comparable campuses in the area are making. For example, at BU and MIT, the wages are closer to $17 to $20. And other workers at Harvard, for example, dining hall workers, museum guards, people like that, are making $14, $15 an hour. Security guards have really been left behind. They're the only ones still making $12.60 an hour. And so that's what this campaign is about. We feel that they at least deserve parity with the other workers on our campus. The living wage in the area is much more than $12.60 an hour. There's different estimates, but it ranges up to $20 an hour. And we're saying $12.60 is just not enough.
Jamila, we have just 30 seconds, but when do you plan to end this fast?
We don't know. We haven't planned an end to it yet. But regardless of what happens with the fast, the campaign isn't over until officers are getting the demands that they've put forward.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, Jamila Martin and Benjamin Landau Bespiel, senior and freshman at Harvard University, with Student Labor Action Movement calling for security guards to get increased pay. They are in the ninth day of a hunger fast. As we end today's program.
Yes, and we want to end that with a Mother's Day special. Filmmaker Robert Greenwald has just produced a short film titled Mother's Day for Peace. It features a dramatic reading of Julia Ward Howe's Mother's Day Proclamation by Felicity Huffman, Christine Lati, Fatma Salah, Ashrami Salimian, Vanessa Williams, and Alfre Woodard. This excerpt begins with Gloria Steinem.
Mother's Day really was, in its origin, an anti-war day, an anti-war statement. Julia Ward Howe was sickened by what had happened during the Civil War, the loss of life, the carnage, and she created Mother's Day as a call for women all over the world to come together and create ways of protesting war, of making a kind of alternate government that could finally do away with war as an acceptable way of solving conflict.
Arise then, women of this day. Arise, all women who have hearts. Whether your baptism be of water or of tears,
say firmly, we will not have questions answered by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands will not come to us reeking of carnage for caresses and applause.
Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We
the women of one country, are too tender to those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm.
Disarm.
Disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice.
Blood does not wipe our dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have
often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead.
Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace. Each bearing after his own time the sacred impress,
not of Caesar, but of God.
In the name of womanhood and humanity, I earnestly ask that a general congress of women without limit of nationality
may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient.
And at the earliest period consistent with its objects.
To promote the alliance of the different nationalities.
The amicable settlement of international questions.
The great and general interest of peace.
The full movie can be seen at mothersdayforpeace.com. Robert Greenwald produced the film to raise money for the group No More Victims. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Shreef Abdulkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Maté, and Jen Utes. Happy birthday to Luai Abu Aspa. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Also, special thanks to Angela Alston, Becca Staley, Susie Salami, Rebecca Silver, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Gillian O'Connor, Jerome Bourgeois, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, and Samantha Chamblay. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to get our headlines, our news stories, to sign up for our daily digest. We also video and audio podcast there. That's at democracynow.org. Next Wednesday, I'll be in Windsor, Ontario, speaking there, and we'll be broadcasting the next day from Detroit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!